I'm Andrew Pratt. I'm the managing editor for Science Progress. I'm joined in the studio today by two of my colleagues here at the Center for American Progress, Bill Schultz, who's a senior fellow here and was the former executive director of Amnesty International USA, as well as Sarah Dreyer, who is a former researcher here at the Center for American Progress and is now at the University of Washington.
They are the authors of a new report from the Center for American Progress called New Tools for Old Traumas, Using 21st Century Technologies to Combat Human Rights Atrocities.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Bill. So today, what we're going to talk about is science and human rights and how collaborations between scientists and human rights workers have actually helped solve some human rights dilemmas around the world and maybe also potentially headed off future human rights violations and problems in the future. But this is not necessarily a kind of collaboration that everyone is familiar with. In some ways, these kinds of collaborations between scientists, technologists, and human rights advocates are new. They're very cutting edge. They're as new as the technologies themselves. So I wanted to start by talking about a really concrete example that's actually been around for a few years, collaborations between geospatial scientists and human rights advocates using satellite imagery to watch what's going on the ground in some hotspots around the world. And in your new report that talks about these collaborations, you look at some specific examples of places where this collaboration has really worked, in Burma, in Ethiopia, and in Darfur. These are very vivid examples of these kinds of collaborations. So I'm wondering if one of you could explain how these eyes in the sky can actually help protect and preserve human rights.
Well, it's not a surprise, of course, that governments that commit human rights violations often want to keep those human rights violations secret. And, of course, often those are governments that are ruling countries that are inaccessible, sometimes geographically and physically inaccessible, always inaccessible in terms of information flows. So the fact that satellite images are able to penetrate that inaccessibility is enormously helpful to human rights advocates. And you've given some important examples. Burma, clearly a closed society. Ethiopia, that denied that there was repression going on in the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, one of the most rugged and remote parts of that country. Labor camps in North Korea that were disclosed through satellite imaging. North Korea, of course, one of the most closed societies in the world. One of the most interesting projects was a collaboration between Amnesty International and the American American Association for the Advancement of Science, which has been using satellite imaging on behalf of human rights for the past several years. In this case, this relates to Darfur. Those satellites were positioned to give images of particular villages in Darfur that were under potential threat from the Janjaweed militia and their allies in the Sudanese government. And then those images were posted on Amnesty's website, and Amnesty's activists were invited to keep, quote, eyes on Darfur. And the Sudanese government was informed that this was going to be happening. And of the dozen or so villages, only one village has subsequently been subject to attack. That's a very practical example of the way in which satellite imaging has protected people on the ground. Interestingly enough, the International Criminal Court has invited the American Association for the Advancement of Science to share its imaging in Darfur with the court, which it has done, and has made clear that the fact that the court has had access to these images of what's happened on the ground in Darfur contributed to the indictments that the court has brought against Bashir, the president of Sudan, and a number of other Sudanese officials. So in the long run, this will be an important weapon in ending impunity for these kinds of crimes.
It's really interesting that this is an NGO, a science-focused NGO working with a human rights organization. They don't own these satellites. Getting access to these images can be tricky. It can be expensive. What are some of the obstacles to these collaborations between scientifically focused NGOs and human rights NGOs?
When the AAAS receives an account of a destructed village, they face a number of obstacles before they can actually display images and say, here's an indication that a village has been destructed. First, when they receive an indication or a report that a village has been attacked, there's a difficult process to even get the coordinates of the village itself. First of all, names vary from, you know, the locally identified names of the villages vary from official records of villages. Often in many places, there are no databases that have village-specific locations. And so even this first step of identifying the coordinates of a potentially destroyed village is a very complicated process, and the scientists at AAAS have to use a variety of different mapping sources, a variety of different database sources to even find the coordinates. Once they find the coordinates, they need to procure both images of the village before that existed before the alleged destruction, and then they have to order from commercial satellites that are constantly orbiting the globe. They have to order these specific images to be purchased, and that costs up to $2,000 per image. So it's a really, really onerous cost, especially for NGOs. And then once they've received these two different images, then they have to analyze it and identify, you know, how things have been destructed, what the images actually tell us about, you know, which structures are still there and which have been destroyed and are likely to have been the cause of violence. And then the final obstacle, of course, is once everything has been analyzed, to get the images out there and to use this information, the scientific information, in the right hands, so that there can be something done. And so that final hurdle is, you know, the need to find political will to identify that these violences are going on and create some substantive change so that we can end these atrocities.
This sounds like a very complicated process. In addition to being able to make robust arguments about what people are seeing, it's obviously we can't just go on Google Maps and support this work. Well, I want to ask you both, since you are both coming more from a human rights perspective rather than from a scientific and technological background, what was the inspiration for this particular report? Was this work that you had done previously? Had you observed these kinds of collaborations? Why did you feel like this marriage of science and human rights was something that you needed to talk about more?
Well, the truth is that human rights advocates have always utilized the latest technology, particularly the latest technologies in communication, to advance their cause. If you think back upon it, in the 18th and early 19th century, the abolitionist movement could never have been successful without changes in printing technology that allowed for massive expansion of newspapers and the availability of newspapers. If we look at the Holocaust, that came to the attention of the world through those famous newsreels and the photographs of what had actually happened in the camps run by the Nazis. If you look at the civil rights movement in this country, the images of Bull Connor's dogs attacking the civil rights workers, or of the peaceful sit-ins in the South, that transformed the civil rights movement into a national movement and really made a difference. So during the last few years of my tenure at Amnesty, which ended in 2006, we were seeing a remarkable expansion of the ability through, of course, the internet, through viral marketing, through flash animations. We were seeing remarkable expansion of our ability to reach literally tens and hundreds of thousands of people very, very quickly with the truth, with the kind of messages, with the activist inspiration that we wanted to provide. And as we looked into this area, Amnesty and others were pioneers in the areas, I've said, of satellite mapping. We recognized that there are so many ways in which developments in technology can make a difference to human rights, and that's what this report is attempting to stimulate.
And why is it important at this particular moment? You write a little bit about the focus of the Obama administration and their stance on human rights and their orientation towards science and technology as well. Why is this an opportune moment to talk about this kind of collaboration?
Well, I think we're seeing two parallel tracks here within the new administration. On the one hand, as you've just alluded to, Andrew, we're seeing a renewed commitment to science and innovation, a commitment on the part of the president to put significant new money into this field, to expand the budget of the National Science Foundation, a recognition that the United States simply has to remain competitive in the field of innovation. At the same time, we know that the president is attempting to reestablish the United States' international reputation as a moral leader, as a human rights leader, as a responsible player, a responsible international citizen. These two things are going on at the same time, and what we're saying is that there needs to be cross-fertilization between the two, because in fact that innovation can reinforce the United States' efforts and image as a responsible international player.
Now that really makes a whole lot of sense, and it seems like the appeal could speak to people in the human rights arena because these are the newest tools that will actually improve their work, and can also appeal to those scientists who felt that maybe the drift away from the more altruistic components of their work got lost, perhaps under the previous administration, a way of melding those two missions together. So we've talked a little bit about satellite imagery, which is, for a lot of people, a very concrete, easy to understand, easy to visualize example of this technology. But there's another well-established area of research that supports human rights work, and that's medical forensics. And so whereas the satellite imagery can protect people from future violence and maybe help right past wrongs, a lot of the medical forensics work is more focused on this redressing of past wrongs and has an important role to play in some of the justice proceedings and some of the court work to bring people to justice for war crimes. Can you talk a little bit about some of the examples in the paper of where medical forensics has helped support human rights activities?
Well, you're absolutely right about that, Andrew. And of course, most famously, we know of the mass graves in Srebrenica and the evidence that was gathered of human rights crimes that took place there. But that's been repeated in a wide variety of places. And the fact is that if courts don't have this kind of tangible information, they can't bring justice to the perpetrators for the families of the victims. And the families themselves can't reach closure. They often don't know what happened to their loved ones. And while, of course, it's tragic when they find out that they were part of a mass grave, it does at least close the circle. And the combination of those two is absolutely essential. And we're seeing remarkable forensic developments in places like Guatemala, where bodies are being put back together, and with the help of DNA analysis in addition, our cases are being built against those who committed these kinds of crimes. It's an important area of development. And as you say, yes, it has happened. Physicians for Human Rights is one of those groups that has taken the lead in this respect and has done this all over the world, but it needs to be expanded.
Now, some of the mass grave sites where these forensic investigations happen, for instance, in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia, as you were alluding to, are literally in war zones. They're in very dangerous places. So that presents some serious challenges for the people who are going in and gathering evidence. And I'm wondering what exactly is the role that U.S. agencies can play in helping support this work and create policies that can facilitate this particular research?
Well, certainly there are always ways that the U.S. government agencies can be more supportive of these efforts. In the case of forensics, they've actually been a leader in helping fund NGOs and scientists to support these efforts, and that's been an important role that they have actually played. Unfortunately, there are a couple of cases where the U.S. government representatives have not been as supportive as they need to be. A recent example indicates some places in which, the U.S. government didn't act as they should. Satellite imagery revealed the existence of some mass graves that we believe were created and done at the hands of U.S. allies in Afghanistan. And there's evidence that U.S. personnel were at worst or at best not supportive of excavation efforts, and at worst actually impeded those efforts to excavate graves. And so we want to emphasize the fact that U.S. Government representatives have a responsibility at any point to support the excavation of mass graves and to support any other efforts to reveal evidence of human rights abuses.
I want to go back to a point that you were making earlier, Bill, about communication tools and the important role that they've not just played in recent history, but over the past several hundred years, actually, of human rights work. So one emerging area of technology-enabled human rights work that you write about in this report is communications technology, either web-based or through mobile phones. And there's one, I think, worthwhile example to look at for a moment, which is called Frontline SMS, which is a technology that allows human rights and public health workers to communicate over their own separate text-based network. Can you talk about some of the examples that you explain for this particular technology and the kind of work that's being done with it?
Yeah, Frontline SMS is a perfect example of simple tools, tools that we here in the U.S. often take for granted, and the influences and impacts that they can have in places and parts of the world that are not as connected via cell phone and internet as we are accustomed to here and we take for granted. It's a cheap, easy to use software system that essentially uses one single laptop as a hub that connects cell phones to this the operator of this hub, which can be a healthcare provider, a human rights activist, a humanitarian, someone with information about agricultural developments, and it allows this person at the hub to communicate via text message to hundreds of remote communities. And all it requires is one cell phone in every community and one volunteer in every community to hold that cell phone, and then they suddenly have access to a wealth of knowledge, whether it's healthcare information, whether it's information about weather patterns that would affect agriculture and is essential for food security, whether it's someone who can aggregate reports of election violations, people who have been turned away at the polls or who's feel that their votes weren't appropriately counted, and This simple tool that's cheap and easy to set up has great impacts. In the healthcare example, for instance, it has allowed these cell phone carrying volunteers in the communities to glean important information so that they can service people in their communities who are sick. It has enhanced communication and allowed healthcare providers to get more information and more services to more people in these communities than they otherwise would have been able to. They're saving money on gas, so they don't have to travel to communities as much, and when they do, it can be effective travel. They're saving hours, and the result is that for very low costs, they're providing important life-saving services. And one of the beauties of this technology is that it allows communities to take technology that exists and apply it in ways that they know need to be applied. So it's not just the creators of Frontline SMS, who are from the UK, coming to rural Malawi and saying, "Here's what you need." It's the creators of these technologies coming to these places and say, "Here is a resource, and you can use it and change it in a way so that you can apply it in the ways that you need it to be applied."
I think that's a really important point that you're making, because for a lot of these technology and communications-enabled human rights solutions, one of the most important things is to just improve access to networks, improve mm-hmm. access to mobile phones, to internet connections, to broadband in places where it doesn't exist so that people can communicate and as we were talking about at the beginning, understand and reveal what's going on. So what are some of the concrete policy steps that the federal government could take to support expansion of these types of communication?
Well, the biggest barrier is this still existing, what we call the digital divide between those of us who, you know, can wake up in the morning and send 3 text messages and check our, you know, 4 different email addresses and read the New York Times online, and people who, you know, phone lines and internet capacities are faulty, unpredictable, or non-existent. So the biggest thing that we can do is, you know, the U.S. government can partner with NGOs and internet service providers to take concrete steps to get internet and cell phone coverage to places like rural Africa that don't have it. The U.S. government can continue to support free expression against authoritarian regimes, which often at fear of mobilization and protest can cut out internet access and even cell phone coverage in their countries. So those are the big things that the U.S. government can do and should take a lead role in implementing. But there are other minor things, like comparatively minor things that would have a huge impact. Like, you know, we are calling on cell phone service providers to provide text messages at free or reduced costs for those who are using frontline SMS and other humanitarian efforts, because that's something that, you know, is a low cost on the part of the cell phone service providers, but, you know, even a 1 to 10 cent text message fee for these healthcare providers in rural Africa is an onerous cost. And so, as part of their corporate social responsibility platforms, we call on service providers to find ways to make those services more available.
There's a point that you make in your report about the two different mindsets of the communities, the human rights community and the scientific research community. Now, for scientists, it's very important to present findings objectively to make sure that you present your evidence and that the evidence supports your conclusions. From a human rights perspective, a lot of the work that you're doing is politicized. It may be running contrary to the interests of particular governments or multiple governments, and there's a tension at work between researchers who may have a problem with their objective work being politicized and with human rights advocates who may be frustrated with the amount of time and the peer review process that scientific work goes through. But what strikes me as particularly interesting is that both of these communities are sort of working towards their particular conception of truth, of the real facts that are out there. And I wonder if that's a connection that you see between these two communities that can help support this kind of work, that's striving for accuracy.
Absolutely. After all, the fact is that human rights truth, moral or political truth as it may be, is only as good as its credibility and its accuracy. And the minute that a human rights organization loses that sense of credibility, makes charges that can't be substantiated, or promotes a particular position that in fact is undermined when the full factual reality is placed before the world, that does enormous damage to the human rights cause. At the same time, I think we all know that science has often been criticized for failing to recognize that it also has a responsibility for how its quote, objective truth is utilized in the world. No better example, of course, being in the area of armaments. And so I think that there is a way that these two communities not only have but can in the future come together and recognize their mutual support for one another, mutual, I won't say dependence, but certainly the ways in which each of them can can make advantageous alliance with one another. And certainly from a human rights point of view, the more that human rights advocates are willing to recognize that, yes, it may take a little longer, it may be complicated, you may not understand the math and the technology, but at the end of the day, if you have a firm footing for whatever it is that you're saying, and, of course, resources with which then to mobilize people around the world to support what you're saying, that in the long run, that kind of use of truth will be of great advantage.
Sarah and Bill, they are the authors of New Tools for Old Traumas, Using 21st Century Technologies to Combat Human Rights Atrocities. Thank you so much, both,
thank you, Andrew,
for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks.